you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
We're coming along today to look at the last of our programmes on road. And as with anything, there is, as you get towards the present, a question of where one puts the emphasis and the extent to which the present day is one that can be seen in light of the past, how far there are helpful parallels to make. Now, what I want to try and do is to focus on the current situation and pick out themes that I think would be regarded as important in the future and also are consequential if somebody is looking at the situation from abroad. And then if we've got time, I'm very much hoping Graham's going to take the lead here to have some discussion about long-term trends. But we're talking in 2024, and I think the point that one needs to make is twofold. One, that the roads remain dominant, and as has been the case throughout the situation very clearly from the 1950s, even more 60s onwards. And yet at the same time, there are unprecedented rates of complaint about the roads, both about the conditions of the roads and the circumstances in which people drive on them. Now, it needs to be said that, of course, the aggregate population size at the present moment is unprecedented. It's growing at an unprecedented rate. We have unprecedented numbers of motor vehicles. And we don't have, I'm not saying we should or we shouldn't, I'm not talking about public policy at this point, we don't have a pro rata increase in road or road space or indeed parking space. So that there are obviously going to be great pressures, not only in the flow of people, but also in moving goods in order to provide for this number of people. And I think it's worth saying that at the same time, much of the discussion looks at the attempt to create new vehicles, whether electric cars or hybrid cars, or now even alternatives to cars in the shape of e-scooters or e-bikes or drones, the last for freight. None of these have alleviated the degree of public disquiet. And you can see that in particular at the extent to which recent attempts at the regulation of road use, there have been attempts, obviously, over the last century and before, but the pace of regulation and the intensity of regulation is getting much greater than ever before. And it includes on issues of speed and safety, or what are presented as issues relating to speed and safety, and also the use of regulatory revenue and pollution. All of those have led to quite heightened public debate about roads, attempts to control the type of vehicle employed, notably engine type and fuel, as well as routes. And this has caused particular contention when pricing and control policies were introduced. One can think, for example, at the destruction of ULEZ cameras in London, particularly South London last year, but also more generally. So to take, for example, my local St. Leonard's Neighbourhood News, not exactly the acme of the press, but anyway, the editorial for the September-October issue was, the issue itself was fronted with a caricature deriding traffic planners as bullying obsessives, heedless of all else. And the editor commented, quote, "The whole city seems currently in the throes of turmoil and anger over much bigger traffic charges, especially those designed to make the heart of Heavytree," that's the neighbouring suburb, "a ghetto," a rather emotive phrase. Now, this, of course, was not the view of Devon County Council, which in its, quote, "Heavytree and Whipton Active Streets Trial" leaflet, I loved the idea of active streets, explained the purpose of the relevant experimental traffic regulation order. These are fascinating documents. "To help create quieter streets for walking and cycling A number of traffic filters and bus gates will be installed. Traffic filters use bollards and planters to prevent the passage of vehicular traffic except for buses and certain other exempt classes of vehicles. These restrictions will be enforceable by the police. Bus services and walking cycling routes will be unaffected by the changes. All properties will remain accessible by car and taxi, but some people may need to use alternative routes for certain journeys. Well, let me tell you, I don't drive, so I'm not complaining in any, but let me tell you, what it has done is heavily clogged up all the surrounding roads. There have been scenes in Heavytree where the number of vehicles going through where they're not supposed to go through, of course the police have got other things to do like fill in forms, have led to citizen protests, i.e. people having rows and argy-bargy with each other. And it's certainly not the case that the volume of traffic is significantly reduced. It's just reorganized in a very incoherent fashion. No or low car zones, in fact, more generally, are based on flawed assumptions about the mobility of much of the population and their need to transport items that they require. I mean, it's ironic that at a time when the percentage of the population who are elderly is increasing and that they do need access, those needing to transport loads and to work or for deliveries, the elderly, the infirm, they are all being badly hit. And it's worth pointing out that if you certainly take my area, the Greens and Labour, who particularly the Greens, who push most hardly, their prime demographic are fit people in their 20s and 30s. Now, fit people in their 20s and 30s are fully entitled to be actively represented in the electoral process. But I think it's fair to say that, in a sense, old people are supposed to disappear through holes in the ground. And it's, you know, there are practical problems with all of these no or low car zones. And most recently, as in last week, there's been a lot of fuss about the extent to which they lead to serious delays for buses in South London. So they don't necessarily help public transport. On top of that, the zeal for no or low car speeds is in a way linked to the popularity of electric cars as a design to strike at pollution. But it's worth noting that the public popularity of electric cars has declined. Indeed, Auto Trader polls comparing 2019 and 2023 have revealed serious issues here, not least due to the cost of the cars, the lack of easy charging infrastructure, and worries about their range. It also ought to be mentioned that buses catching fire is not proving the best advertisement. You know, electric buses catching fire is not proving the best advertisement for people, although I suppose it saves on a journey to Switzerland if you feel that you've reached the end of your tether. These concerns about electric cars have compromised the attraction of the proposed 2030 ban on new petrol and diesel models, and the issue came to the political fore in September 2023 when there were calls for delays in proposed changes. In the event that month, the Prime Minister, Mr. Sunak, it may seem unnecessary to mention him, but I suspect if this programme is listened to, in 5 years' time, people might ask who he. Mr. Sunak declared that 80% of all new cars would have to be electric by 2030, although the ban on the sale of new petrol cars by 2030 was pushed back till 2035, by when apparently 100% of all new cars were to be electric, with Sunak claiming that politicians hitherto had not been honest with the public about the cost of net zero. I think that's a fair comment. I suspect there will be even more dishonesty under the new government. Separately, new hybrid cars, which use a combination of electric and conventional fuels, are to be banned in 2035. So in other words, the petrol-powered internal combustion engine is intended for the knife. But with private ownership, the second-hand car market, and the cost to individuals of replacement, making the transition for cars far more problematic. In 2015, British motorists bought 2.6 million new cars. There were also many purchasers of second-hand cars, a practice made much easier by online information, which transformed that market. The average distance travelled each day per person has risen. Indeed, by 2000, it risen to about 20 miles, which was an increase of 3/4 over a quarter century. Now, 20 miles is too far for people to walk to work. It's not very easy in most of the country, and anyway, most people aren't suited to do it, to cycle to work. And outside London, the bus system is pathetic, and the train system is generally weak. So this increase helped to drive not only for more cars, including more cars per family, but also for more space for the associated infrastructure, such as garages and parking. And indeed, the rise in the number of cars per family put more pressure on parking. And you won't be surprised to hear, those who don't live in Britain, that the foolish attempt in Britain to regulate this is simply not to provide parking spaces or adequate parking spaces in new developments, which simply ensures that cars are higgledy-piggledy parked, often illegally and dangerously. In suburban areas, this problem has resulted in the paving over of front gardens, which has been very much a land use consequence of transport developments. There was also the misguided drive in response to rising car use to increase motorway capacity by smart motorways, so-called, in which hard shoulders were used as a running lane. Furthermore, as part of another crisis, many cars have become larger, notably on the American model, and particularly as SUVs, sports utility vehicles. It always makes me feel funny when they're referred to in terms of sport, since most people have a girth as big as mine and were completely incapable of sport. Sports utility vehicles enjoy great popularity. There are particular problems for parking with SUVs, not least the obsolescence of existing garages, many of which were therefore used for other purposes, as well as major problems in car parks. SUVs also have affected other road users, whether car cyclists, riders, or pedestrians, as well as indeed other drivers. And there's been a social as well as a regional dimension, as so often in the case of transport history, as with the description of SUVs as Chelsea tractors, a term that captures antipathy, indeed hostility, towards wealthy Londoners with second homes in the countryside. So I think it's fair to say that there is a multiple sense of tension. And the attempt by planners to limit car usage by authorising new developments in which houses or flats had few or no parking spaces has led to quarrels between neighbours, which offered a variation on road rage, which itself has become a greater problem. Indeed, a classic cause of small-scale altercations, brawls and vandalism arises from homeowners or tenants assuming, wrongly, that parking at the street-side curb outside their dwelling should be used only by them. And residents' parking permit schemes do not solve this issue. Another aspect of road rage developed from tension between cars and cyclists, each complaining about the other. Linked to this, but also separate, car speed has become a major issue. Although the earlier move in Scotland attracted less opposition, the move to 20 mile an hour speed limits on residential roads in Wales in 2023 caused controversy and was unpopular. The law of 2022 making this possible prompted protests, with motorists in Wales tying red ribbons to their car, a reference to the Locomotive Act of 1865, known as the Red Flag Act, which imposed very strict speed limits and requiring a person waving a red flag to walk in front of vehicles. Yesterday, I don't live in Wales, not near it. I was actually told a joke by a senior politician, which I rather liked. He said to me that the purpose of the 20 mile an hour speed limits in Wales is to deal with the problem that so many people wanted to leave it. I leave that joke for listeners to decide what they make of that. In London, the Critic magazine, of course, totally disassociates itself from that joke. In London, also, the speed limit on more than half the roads were cut to 20 mile an hour, with 125,000 speeding fines issued in April and May 2023. It's a racket, in other words. Average speeds on A roads across Greater London fell to 14.4 miles an hour in 2002. There was a clear political dimension, with only London Conservative run outer London councils, such as Bromley, against low traffic neighbourhoods. The bulk of the London, Greater London Authority area, the Labour councils, being very much in favour of them. Defenders of the schemes say that because traffic flows flow more smoothly, average journeys are not greatly increased. But I think it's fair to say that there has been much unhappiness and concern about the economic costs of these policies. By 2022, there were 33 million cars registered in Britain. Drivers in the 10 most congested cities spent 80 hours in traffic jams. Traffic projections are projections, not least because of issues of energy availability, but traffic could increase. The Department of Transport suggests by as much as 54% by 2060 because of population growth and cheaper to run electric vehicles. For any form of road vehicle, of course, the marginal cost of driving is relatively low once the vehicle is owned. The key cost is the purchase, and therefore for people who decide to purchase the cars, it's sensible to drive them. Very differently, the impact of the car has also been particularly apparent in rural areas. It facilitates the mobility of most rural consumers, but was also linked to the closure of many rural schools, shops, pubs, churches and post offices, greatly affecting the fabric of rural life and the nature of community. Conversely, these closures and the fact that by 2000, 75% of rural parishes had no daily bus service, and those that they do have are generally infrequent, encouraged dependence on cars. There's also a class element. The wealthy could afford to take taxis to and from pubs and thus observe drink driving laws, whereas the poor are often in considerable difficulties, unable to afford cars or having to spend too large a percentage of their money on them or keeping their cars in not able to keep them in good nick with all the problems that these pose. Incidentally, the extent of rural potholes further magnifies the issues involved in looking after cars in rural areas. So I think it's worth saying that we have got serious problems. It was the case that the COVID and working from home led to a cut in car driving from 263 billion miles in 2019 to 244 billion in 2022. Incidentally, also changing traffic peaks from before 9 a.m. on weekdays to later in the day and at weekends. But since COVID has ended, the pressure again has been upwards, and there are repeated problems on the roads. There are also problems with being able to afford maintenance, and I think that is being exacerbated in terms of local roads by the financial crises facing many local authorities, while at the national level, the inexorable drive to spend money on health and social welfare causes obvious problems in the provision of funds to maintain national road systems. In order to give you some sort of comparison, Whilst cars and taxis drove about 240 billion miles, light commercial vehicles were 57.5 billion, heavy goods vehicles 17.4 billion, buses and coaches 2.1 billion, motorcycles 2.8 billion, and pedal cycles 3.9. Now, what you obviously understand from that is however much most people would like public transport, and it's worth bearing in mind that everybody believes in public transport for somebody else. They just want to have the right to drive at whatever they want, whenever they want themselves. But even if you doubled the use of buses and coaches, it would be a fragment. It would go up to 4.2 billion as opposed to 240 billion. If you multiplied it by 10 times, it would go up to 21 billion, and that would still be less than 10% of the mileage driven by cars and taxis. So I think it's fair to say that there are many problems there. And of course, there are additional problems due to the extent to which cars going fully electric would, of course, increase demand for electricity by about 24%, it's been estimated, although that doesn't make allowance for the heavy electricity needs of SUVs. And if all road transport went electric, so in other words, lorries, which would use a lot more, then one's talking about maybe around 40%. It's true, electricity is more efficient in converting energy into motion than petrol, but there would still be significant problems in making provision for the necessary amount of electric provision, and it's simply not there at the moment. And, you know, there are major inadequacies that one needs to think about and that people don't seem willing to think about. So I myself, I'm, of course, a pessimist, and people don't like to hear from pessimists, but I myself am not sanguine about the current situation. And I think, if I may, I would say that we are in a situation in which, while it cannot be seen that there is a viable alternative to mass transport, both of people and of freight, nevertheless, the existing transport of both of them is pressing very hard on a sort of built environment for transport that is inadequate, and it is based on many flawed assumptions about the availability of public and private funds in order to help individuals and public institutions out of the problem. Over to you.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Jeremy. There are so many themes to draw together from this podcast and also the preceding podcast that's led up to it. But I think the theme which separates the previous podcast from this one is, in previous podcasts, roads have been getting better, faster, more used. In this podcast, you know, covering mostly the 21st century, it's the real or perceived problems of roads, the efforts by many policymakers to make driving by car in particular more difficult, more expensive, more hassle in order to drive, I shouldn't use the word drive, in order for travellers to use less fuel-intensive, yes, carbon fuel-intensive forms of travel. I think back to the kind of earlier themes that led us to this place. There was a campaign against lead in petrol, the pollution of lead in petrol, which has successfully removed lead in petrol. There were fights, environmental fights against some of the bypasses of the late 1990s, Newbury, for example, because of the threat to local trees and so on. But now it seems with the march to net zero that it's all at a much more macro level. To what extent do you feel that government and the governments of the 21st century, which since 2010 have either been conservative or conservative-led, has really driven this change, or does it seem to you, as it does to me, that we have a government that is committed to it in principle, but actually isn't sure really what it's doing and you know, how far it's practical to pursue policies which it doesn't actually make you know, the proper infrastructure in place for, particularly you know, the charging points for electric vehicles?
Well, I think it's not so much a that implies a kind of almost dishonesty. I don't so much think it's a kind of dishonesty. I think it's the dysfunctional nature of government, and in particular, the extent to which there is, on the one hand, a habit of proclaiming ends and goals, and on the other hand, a lack of the means to apply the resources of the state and to elicit public consent and public funds, the funds of the public, in order to produce these outcomes. So, I mean, in a sense, the idea that you would somehow find charging easy is clearly flawed. I mean, clearly it's very flawed indeed. But you don't, as a politician in any party, either in government or opposition, do very well in saying, possibly one should say, I would, of course, but then that's the nature of me as the beast, would say, you know, there's only so much we can do. We need to be cautious. Funds are limited. Okay, you want to spend X million on this. Where's the money going to come from, etc., etc.? That's not the way that people live in modern Britain, where they want to believe that somehow you can will something and the outcomes that's possible.
But it doesn't seem to me that government has fought things through at a more broad level, which is to say, on the one hand, the population of Britain is rapidly accelerating in recent years, primarily through the encouragement of immigration. But at the same time, the costs of building new railways, of which high speed is the most obvious example, have become prohibitive and take years to plan and do. And yet there isn't a desire to build lots more roads to accommodate the greater population moving around because of the zeitgeist against the car. It doesn't seem to me that this government, and perhaps many other governments as well, in other countries, really has been able to square these competing claims.
I think you're right. I don't think they have. I think in many senses they're in really quite serious problems, but I don't think that it actually makes them any different from large areas of policy. It doesn't necessarily make it different from issues in health, defence, social welfare, care for the elderly, prisons, all sorts of things, or indeed housing policy, encouraging people to be healthy, and you know, encouraging people to maintain freedom, but at the same time live in the kind of society that the government wants you to live in. And equally, what's worth bearing in mind, we're scarcely alone in this. There are many other countries which have dysfunctional politics. I mean, the problem is, I would suggest to you that there are specific issues of the human geography of Britain, to wit, an unprecedented rise in population, that are causing particular crises. There are also, obviously, the extent to which the changing distribution of population, that people don't live, and it's a good thing in many senses that they don't live. They don't live in close-packed hovels, you know, eking their way out to a nearby, you know, smokestack factory. They have, in some respects, a more attractive lifestyle, and that more attractive lifestyle includes mobility, which at the individual level is marvellous, but at the collective level creates problems.
Well, you rightly say it's not a confusion just of the British government. I mean, if I can give another example, and I give the example to try and tease out where policy may go next. I know you're a historian, not a futurologist, but there's always been this promise that the cost of electric vehicles to purchase will come down. even though it isn't clear that actually that is the case, but there's just an assumption that once enough are made, the price will come down. Well, the Chinese are now being accused by both British and European governments of flooding the market with cheap EVs, which domestic competitors can't possibly produce it at the same level. So there's this conflict. Do we encourage people to take up EVs which are price competitive to purchase, but they're all made and heavily subsidized in China? Or do we decide there are actually important strategic reasons for not letting China dominate our market here, but in which case the price of producing cars stays very high? Where do you see this playing? How do you see this playing out?
Well, I think that how I see it playing out is that the limited capacity of Western Europe to evade, if you like, the consequence of outsourcing so much industrial production to China is such that I can't quite see how they are going to be able to evade or avoid a degree of dependence. Now, obviously, at the present moment, that is the prime driver in, other than anger and concern about Russia and foreign policy. But, you know, you could easily have a situation in which you have a new president of the United States, maybe Donald Trump, who decides to make some kind of what he thinks of as a historic deal with China. And suddenly we're all told we ought to be trading with China again. So I think we have to be prepared to accept that our ability to dictate a foreign policy of mercantilist economics is less to the fore than we might imagine.
I want to end by really asking a question whether we're coming full circle. So much talk amongst urbanists and planners about creating hindrances for short time frame travel, so taking the car within one's own town or city. The emergence of this idea of the 15-minute city, in which huge impediments are created, including financial impediments, for people to drive around their own city or to different parts of their own town or city. Are we heading back to a more medieval time frame where the idea that the world is shrinking is no longer embraced, and actually one needs to be local and not move around? And if that is the case, how is that compatible with a modern globalized world where people are necessarily traveling long distance in order to meet financial and economic imperatives?
Well, it's quite simply authoritarian. It bears no reference to the way in which most people now live. Most people will not find a bank branch within 15 miles. They won't find an optician within 15 miles. They won't find a dentist that's able to deal with them within 15 miles. So it is a kind of nasty way of treating fellow human beings in order to pursue a particular cult figure. Why 15 miles has been picked out? It's a very, very, very controlling. I don't like using the term Orwellian because for many listeners it doesn't mean anything. But I mean, this is truly authoritarian, and I think it is very unattractive indeed. And I'm afraid to say that public authorities over the last X number of years, they've in this country largely been Conservative or Labour. Unfortunately, the Conservatives have largely lost sight of any idea of significant public freedom. And I'm not sure that many people in the Labour Party have any commitment to it, and other than in the most obstructive fashion of a theory of public freedom, but a practice of telling other people what to do.
Well, we're likely to have a Labour government, but certainly before this year is out. Just as a final thought, assuming this more authoritarian attitude continues to prevail for the next 5 years or so, where do you see the future of cars and road network in Britain?
Well, I don't know. I mean, predicting the future is an issue of all sorts of problems. I mean, you know, I was discussing at lunchtime what the country would look like if there was a Russian hypersonic missile fired at a major arms depot sending arms to Ukraine. I have no idea what might happen, but obviously one can make some suggestions. I think that the attempt to move towards electric vehicles, and as I said, it doesn't concern me directly because I don't drive, but the attempt to move towards electric vehicles is based on a totally flawed analysis of the economics of most people in the country and most small businesses. So I can't see how that one's going to work. And I do wonder how things are going to operate if one gets more, as it were, direct action. I don't want to see direct action. I think it's very dangerous for the fabric of our society. But obviously, if you're going to get people blocking roads as a form of direct action, you'll get other people attacking traffic cameras. And I think we have to be clear at this. There is a question about the governability of the country, and that then makes all sorts of consequences for public politics and public policies in the field of transport, as well as much else.
Well, that's a sober yet broad subject upon which to point upon which to end. But for taking us on this long and fascinating history of roads in Britain, Professor Jeremy Black, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. And I think I'm right in saying, Graham, that next week we're going to move on to canals.
We shall indeed be moving on to the history of Britain's canal network.
And indeed the rivers as well, which one needs to remember were there, as it were, before the canals. But we're going to try and do both together.
Indeed. We'll look forward to that. Jeremy, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.